Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Colin McCann's new novel, Twist, is a propulsive book of rupture and repair in the digital age, delving into a hidden world deep under the ocean. Anthony Fennell, a journalist, is in pursuit of a story buried at the bottom of the sea. The network of tiny fiber optic tubes that carry the world's information across the ocean floor, and what happens when they break. So he's traveled to Cape Town to board a cable repair vessel captained by Chief of Mission John Conway. Conway is a talented engineer and fearless freediver, and Fennell was quickly captivated by this mysterious, unnerving man. Colin McCann is the best-selling author of the novels A Paragon, Transatlantic, Let the Great World Spin, This Side of Brightness, and Song Dogs. The latest is Twist, and it's a pleasure to welcome Colin McCann to this week's book show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Joe. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I love your work. I love this novel.
Thank you.
I mentioned in the introduction that Anthony is a journalist. This novel has a journalistic feel to it, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, after I wrote A Paragon, which was kind of I suppose it had a lot of ambition to its structure and so on, I wanted to write a fairly simple book. And I thought, okay, it was during the pandemic. And I thought, okay, I'll write about healing and repair. I'll write a simple, sort of straightforward, chronological story, which turned out to be only sort of halfway through because it became about sabotage as well as repair, and it became a lot more, I don't know, complicated than it was simple, and I'm very happy for that, in fact.
The simple part, in the sense of it's very easy to understand, in the sense that there is something at the bottom of the ocean that is broken, and there are a group of individuals who are going to fix it.
That's correct. And I was amazed when I found the story that 95% of the world's intercontinental information travels underwater, and they're in tubes no bigger than the garden hose. And the tiny fiber optic cables within these tubes are no bigger than your eyelash. They carry the world's information, and actually $10 trillion a day in financial transactions go through those, it's estimated that go through those tubes. But what happens when they get broken? Now, if they get broken close to land, you can have a diver fix them. And if they get broken a little further out, you can have a robot go in, a remote controlled vehicle go in and fix them. But if they get broken deep, deep at sea, the only way to fix them is to trawl with a grappling hook, believe it or not. It's almost like 19th century all over again, and a rope, and to bring up the broken parts, which could have been caused by an earthquake or a landslide or several other things, and then to fuse them together above ground, a process which takes at least a number of weeks, which is kind of scary when you think that there's only 400 cables in the world and there's only 50 repair boats that go out to fix them.
That is stunning. Also, that they're primarily glass, which is doesn't seem to be the most a fairly delicate thing to put at the bottom of the ocean, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you and I are bouncing around right now in a glass tube, as I said, no bigger than a hair, and we are billions of pulses of light, and then they get transmitted and translated, and we come back, and all of this happens in a fraction of a second, which seems to me to be absolutely miraculous. That you know, I was stunned by it, but also stunned by the availability of easy sort of sabotage, because there are landing stations there, say on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast in New York, but there are landing stations all over the world, in Ireland, in countries in Africa, in Egypt, and so on, that are completely unattended. These are like bungalows that you find on beaches where the cables come in, and all of the light gets translated back into new fiber optic cables. And guess what? They basically will have a little chain link fence around them. And I have been at landing stations where I can go and walk along the beach, follow the line of where I think the cable might be, find a manhole cover, reach down. I could, if I wanted to, with a crowbar, prop open that manhole cover and touch the tubes that are pulsing with basically everything that you can possibly imagine, from love letters to graphs to statistics to soccer matches to like all our silly tweets and all our phone calls, all of these things being carried in these tubes that come across the sea. It's amazing.
You talk about your fascination of this subject and how this happens. Give us a sense of what it is that brings Anthony to this story. It's something that he's working on with his editor and said, okay, this is what I want to look at. These are the questions I'm trying to answer.
Well, we're living in fairly broken times. I think we all know that. We're trying to figure out where the shattering is and how we go about figuring out a repair. Anthony Fennell is a broken man. He sort of almost stepped out of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, the T.S. Eliot poem, the lonely men in shirt sleeves. He's a journalist from Ireland, and he wants to go find a story about repair. What he finds is something about repair, yes, but he finds something entirely different too. But he is also trying at the same time to repair himself. He has a son who he's estranged from, and he's a failed novelist, and he's trying to bring all these things together. He comes upon this mysterious other Irish character who's the chief of mission on the boat, who has many missing years about him. And he's also a man who seems intent on instituting repair at the bottom of the sea. But these are fractured times. We all seem to be fracturing in all sorts of ways. And I found myself gravitating towards not only the idea of repair, but how do we get broken, and why do we get broken, and what happens when we try to pick up our pieces afterwards?
The repair, the physical repair, and yet also the repair of us, the human connection repair.
Exactly. It seems to me, I mean, we are living in these tough times, and sometimes we blame the machines that we have. But maybe it's not the machines, maybe it's our relationship to the machines. Maybe if we can look at ourselves and ask ourselves, why do we need that little squirt of dopamine that's shooting through my head when I click the extra page? Why do I need that sight that's going to make me feel a little bit better for 30 seconds? What happens if we step away from all of this, if we consciously look at who we are, what we're doing, and is it the technology that's at fault, or is it ourselves, or could it be that there's a new colonialism sort of going on, a sort of corporate colonialism where these cables are, and the information inside the cables are owned by big companies that are traveling all around the world. In fact, all the cables in the world that carry your information, as I said, there's only like 400 to 450 of them operating right now. They follow the old colonial shipping routes. Almost exactly, they follow the colonial shipping routes. And there's some sort of message there. So I found myself, I didn't set out to do this, but I found myself echoing Joseph Conrad's The Heart of Darkness in certain ways, and also Apocalypse Now. So the book is a sort of homage to The Heart of Darkness, a little homage to Apocalypse Now, but hopefully entirely its own thing too.
You had me watching the two scenes that you talk about. Well, I watched the whole movie, but we're slowly watching those scenes of
Oh, yeah.
Apocalypse Now. It's stunning how you write about it. It's stunning of how just intense that is, and what you write about is what it is for that character, but also what it was for the actor and the director and all who are around watching this moment unfold.
Yeah, it's one of the incredible cinematic moments when he's in the hotel room in Saigon, and he punches the mirror, and Jim Morrison's music, "This is the end, my only friend." is pulsing in the background. And then my question was, what is real? The cinematic version of that scene, which is really incredibly powerful, or the story behind it, which is also incredibly powerful, because Martin Sheen punches the mirror, punches his own reflection. But when he does so, he didn't mean to punch the mirror and break the mirror and cut his hand open, but he did. And he continued doing the scene, so it developed into this iconic thing. So it's really a question of the moment, though, isn't it? Like, what's real? What's not real? What's true? What's not true? And where do we find the truth? And where do we locate it? Which is, in this quote unquote post-truth era, what is it essentially that we're looking for beyond, well, beyond, I don't want to sound twee about it, Joe, but what beyond the elements of the human heart? What are these stories about if they're not about love and pride and pity and sacrifice and compassion and all of these things? Because you can take a fact and you can manipulate a fact, but you can't manipulate an emotion in the same way.
Colin McKenna is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Twist. It is published by Random House. You mentioned Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness. And is it the point? I mean, there are certainly connections there, but I assume once you're in the waters of the Congo River, you're there, right? You're pretty much, okay, this is going to be reminiscent.
Right, that's it. I mean, if you write a novel about a man walking around the streets of Dublin in 1904, even if it takes place in, say, 2004 or 2025, there's going to be some sort of conscious echo of Ulysses. For me, the echo came about, but at first I didn't realize it. I said, okay, I'm on a boat. The boat is going up the western seaboard of Africa. The break that I found, and I went out on a boat myself, the Leon Thevenin. The break that I found was just off the coast of Africa, where the Congo River has expunges itself, if you will. There's a huge flood that comes from the Congo River, which in itself is caused by climate change and a whole, so a lot of these themes come together. Instead of going up the Congo River comes down and takes out our information channels. And to me, that was a really interesting metaphor and a really interesting way to think about it. But we still have the powers that be controlling the information that goes up and down. And, in Africa in particular, you could cut the whole continent off with two main cables. There's a cable that goes on the eastern side and a cable that goes on the western side. If you cut the western side, all the traffic will go to the eastern side and everything will slow down. But if you cut both of them at once, you could cause havoc, not only for the continent and all those countries that have their cables coming off that main cable, but there's a knock-on to Europe, to the Middle East, to America, if we isolate a part of the world. And we've seen it now, believe it or not. Like, my friends are calling me and saying, Colin, what in the world, what sort of publicity campaign or marketing campaign do you have with the Russians now cutting all these cables in the Balkans? Because it's been happening now, the more and more and more these past few months. And we see these stories about Chinese trawlers and Russian trawlers going in. And they're cutting cables because these things are our lifeblood in so many ways.
And the way you've described it, it doesn't seem like it's all that hard, although you do go into a great description in the book of mucking things up.
Right. It's not too hard. I mean, look, state actors might do it or they might not do it. But if you cut off the world's internet, you basically cut off yourself. But there are strategic ways to go, and you could certainly slow things down in certain isolated countries. Like Ireland could be cut off almost completely. New Zealand could be cut off almost completely. It'd be very difficult to cut off the United States, because there are just so many cables coming in, and you would have to have a coordinated campaign of taking numerous cables out at once. But it's actually possible. Look, the impossible and the awful sometimes happens. People fly jetliners into buildings, We learn that sort of thing much to our detriment down through the years, that we should never expect the, or we should sometimes expect the unexpected. If I were writing my James Bond thriller, which I didn't, but maybe I should, if you gave me a half a dozen boats and you gave me about, say, I don't imagine about 20 people who were intent on doing some landside damage and some underwater damage, maybe 10 divers and 20 others, I think I could take the internet down for a fairly considerable amount of time. Should we be scared about that? Yes. Are we scared about it? Not really, because it hasn't happened yet, until we start to see things happening, as I said, now, and the Houthis sort of cutting cables off, and others cutting cables off. And also there's a growing movement against laying down new cables, and a growing movement against our information being owned. So there are ways that one could go about instituting a form of sabotage that would rock us to our knees. I mean, we're scared of software things, but this is hardware. These are like, this is things that clink and clank, and you know, there's copper down there, and there's Kevlar down there, and then there's glass down there, and it can be cut, and it takes a long time after it's cut to try to repair it. And the other thing is, the other thing that I love about it is, it's men and women, but primarily men who go out on these boats, but they're teams. They're almost heroic in a certain sense. They're teams who go out to protect and fix our world's waters. There's very little that has been written about it to this particular point.
We spoke a bit about Anthony Fennell, who is a journalist, is an Irishman, and goes out to find this story. He comes in contact with John Conway, and this is the man who is the captain and is able to do the work and to bring his crew to the point where the work needs to be done. He's a mysterious character from the very first page.
He is mysterious, and you know, for all of those people who might think that I've written a mystery novel, you know, I haven't really written a mystery novel, because nothing really gets solved about him, and that's part of the mystery for me. Part of the beauty about building this character, and in fact building both characters, because there's two Irishmen sort of in opposition to one another, and one who's very forthright about himself, about his life, the other who seems just very mysterious, is out to repair things, and yet we don't know really all that much about him. His life starts to unravel. That's when things start to sort of spin out of control. It was interesting to me to write about two Irish characters, but it's in a global context. You know, it takes place on the west coast of Africa, but it brings in a lot of things about Egypt. It also brings in some things about London. There's a play that takes place in London that has a Beckett play that has a part in the novel. And even though this is a small novel, and to go back to the where we started, you know, I wanted to write a simple, this is funny, I wanted to write a simple love story, right? And of course, it became not a simple love story, and maybe not even a love story. I do think that I achieved what I wanted to achieve, which was to talk about repair and how stories help to repair us in all sorts of ways. And if I may, I just diverge just for a second. One of the things that I've been working on so much in my own life these past few years is bringing young people together to tell stories to one another. Young people from different backgrounds, in a group called Narrative Four. And what happens is that they step into one another's shoes and tell each other's stories in the first person. And my whole belief is that, you know, that stories and storytelling can help us to heal. Part of it is that, well, yes, the world is held together with molecules, but really, when we think about it, our world is also held together with stories, and that's how we meet one another, even across these divides that we have nowadays.
In talking about the characters and the love stories, we meet Zanelli in the book, who is John's partner, and also mysterious. More things come to light, but yes, does an actress does bring us to London, working on a Beckett play, which of course is Waiting for Godot, which in this particular production deals with the issues of climate change.
Yeah, so I actually think that Godot is one of the great climate change plays, and so I have this black South African woman who's in love with this white Irishman. She has to leave him to go to London with what turns out to be not his children, but with her children. She puts on Waiting for Godot against the wishes. Well, originally of Beckett himself, who didn't want women playing in Waiting for Godot, but I think if Beckett came back, he would change his mind about some of the ways that his work is being interpreted. But you know, the idea of waiting for change, or waiting for Godot, and waiting for the one thing on our global stage that doesn't happen, is a metaphor in itself. So if I were actually got a chance to, I did in my head, but if I got a chance to stage Waiting for Godot, I would stage it as a climate play. You know, because the world is in trouble. You probably hear the sirens. I'm calling.
Yes.
You hear the sirens going in the background. It feels like we're in constant siren cycle. And people are asking us, you know, what is it that you can do? And is it stories? Is it storytelling that can help us to heal? You know, what is the job of the writer? What is the job of the artist? And what do we do to alert ourselves to what is going on? Well, this woman who brings out the climate change play in London is trying to alert people to what is going on. Something happens to her that is a small twist in the larger twist of the novel. Not to give too much of the plot away.
Colm McCann is the author of Twist. It is published by Random House. That idea, though, of the twist is interesting, of it even being called that, because it has multiple meanings. And it is really... fascinating to read, again, going back to what you originally said of starting out to write something simple, but then these twists and turns that bring us to a world that was complicated at the beginning and is complicated at the end.
Well, we're all so full of twists and turns. We never know when the twist is gonna come around the corner. What's interesting to me is that, you know, we meet these moments and we never know how it's going to unfold. Of course, in retrospect, we look back on it and tell the story, and we can say, you know, well, this sort of came upon itself logically. For me, it was kind of fascinating to embark again on a book that was purely of the imagination. Yes, it's kind of the real world, because I'm talking about cables and cable breaks and cable repair. But for me, you know, I was inventing characters. Last time round, with the Paragon, I had two characters, one Israeli, one Palestinian, who were real life characters, and I sort of did a hybrid fiction. Even with Let the Great World Spin, I used Philippe Petit, the tightrope walker, as a pull-through metaphor. With these characters out at sea, I had a lot of fun sort of inventing who they were and who they would become. And so all these little twists, and you know, some people say, like some writers, like Nabokov actually said, my characters are my galley slaves. In other words, he could do whatever he wanted to do with them. Not with me. I am not able sometimes to control my character. That they say, I am going to do this. And I would think, but I don't really want you to do this. I don't want you to get off the boat right now. I don't want you to disappear right now. I don't want this stuff to happen in London right now. But it happened, and it was fascinating to get back into pure fiction for me. And that's where a lot of these twists and turns, but also, let's face it, these cables get twisted and they twist up our lives in all sorts of ways. So twist is quite a good word for the turbulent feeling and the turbulent times that we're in right now.
I think I want to go back as we were talking in the beginning about setting out to write a simple book, and I want the listener to know that in your terms, I believe, I mean, you usually write in such a kaleidoscopic fashion. There are many narrators. There is so much going on. Even in Paragon, it's a big book with a lot happening. And this, you have the one narrator. So it's simple in that regard that there is that single voice that brings us to the story.
Right. It's also chronological. He gets on a boat and he follows the boat to a certain point, then he gets off the boat and then he tries to tell the story of the boat. So in that way, it's chronological. And yet there's a lot going on underneath. It's like that old iceberg thing. You see the top of the iceberg and then there's a lot going on. There's a lot of turbulence going on underneath. And I think that's for the reader to find. That to me is the great dignity of being a writer, especially in these days when we get told left, right, and center how to think and who to follow and who to be aligned with. We're also diseased with certainty. Our whole lives are certain. It's nice to get out and to be presented with a sort of a story that we can finish sort of for ourselves, intellectually, even in terms of what happens. To keep a story open. I love my readers, and I hope I get a chance to meet them out on the road again with this book. The last book got taken swamped by the pandemic, so I'm hoping to get out and about and meet people this time round with Twist.
Colin McCann is the author of Twist. The book is published by Random House. Colin, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us. I'm such a fan of this book, such a fan of your work, and it's a delight to have you back on the program.
And thank you so much for your time.
Colin McCann's new novel is Twist. It is published by Random House. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.